It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at the science behind Harry Potter-style magic and science fiction-style technology.
First, we're talking about today's vote to remove Bill Cramer from his position as Wisconsin's Assembly Majority Leader. Two women have accused the Waukesha politician of sexual harassment and verbal abuse while he was in Washington, D.C. last week for a GOP fundraiser.
Yesterday, a third allegation emerged involving a Wisconsin congressional staffer. It's not connected to his time in D.C. last week, though. It apparently happened in the recent past. One of Cramer's aides says he has checked himself into a rehab facility and is not making contact with the outside world.
Today, Assembly Republicans unanimously voted to remove Cramer from his leadership position. Sean Johnson was at the public vote, and he's here to fill us in on what happened. He's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Assembly Republicans unanimously voted to remove Bill Cramer from his position as majority leader today. What was the process and the tone like?
Well, this is a caucus meeting. This is just Assembly Republicans meeting amongst themselves. Often these meetings are closed. In fact, they closed today's meeting for quite a while to talk about what they were going to do. But then they opened it up and, usually in a leadership contest or when you're going to take a step that involves leadership, you have members give speeches for and against people that are running. In this instance, you didn't have anyone stand up and speak on behalf of Bill Cramer, who was not there. He's checked into a treatment facility. You had two representatives stand up and say, we can't have this, we have to get rid of him. And then there was a quick vote, and Assembly Republicans said it was unanimous to get rid of Bill Cramer as majority leader.
Now, you said a couple of people spoke. What did they say?
Basically that we can't tolerate this, that they were disappointed, and that we have to send a message that this is not okay. And then you had not coincidentally, you had two women run for the position to replace Bill Cramer, Representative Mary Williams, Representative Pat Strakota. Both of them are leaving after this legislative session. So, they were only going to hold the job temporarily. They both spoke on behalf of each other. Pat Strakota won that election. And so she now becomes the first woman ever to hold the majority leader position in the Wisconsin State Assembly.
Now, as you said, she's going to be leaving in fairly short order. Why was she chosen with such an early exit date ahead of her?
I think that's probably one of the factors. I mean, they wanted to put this Bill Cramer story behind them as quickly as they could. And if you open this majority leader job up to somebody who might want to hold it for a few years, I mean, it's the number two position in the assembly. And, the action that they're taking to sort of oust Bill Cramer might be overshadowed by the campaign to replace them, So they wanted to move quickly. They wanted to get this over with. And this will give them, whoever wants to be majority leader for the long term, a chance to kind of, prove their worth through campaigning this November. And so we really don't know who those candidates are going to be. But essentially the campaign for that job begins now.
Well, Governor Scott Walker came out earlier in support of removing Cramer for his position as majority leader if the allegations proved credible. How important were the governor's comments in the situation and what happened today?
I think by the time the governor made his comments, they had already pretty much made up their mind. I mean, it's pretty stunning how quickly they acted here. These allegations against Representative Cramer were something that first surfaced in a news report last Friday night. By Saturday, he was supposed to meet with Speaker Voss to discuss what to do going forward, but his office put out a statement, Representative Cramer's office put out a statement saying that he had checked into a treatment center. We don't know much more beyond that. And by that afternoon, Representative Voss's office put out a statement saying, he's lost our trust, and we're going to meet Tuesday to replace him. And there were really no hiccups along the way. So it wasn't as if Scott Walker was going out on a limb there, mm-hmm. making the statements that he did. Cramer was pretty firmly out of the circle of trust by that point.
So it sounds like things were fast-tracked. Were there hints in Bill Cramer's behavior previously that someday there might be an event like this so that maybe people were prepared?
Well, there was a pretty personal hint dropped, actually, when Bill Cramer was elected majority leader. And this was just back in September. You know, as I mentioned, normally when you have elections like this, you have people get up and give speeches on behalf of or against the people running. And in Representative Kramer's case, you had Representative Chris Kapinga, a fellow Waukesha County Republican, get up and say, I've observed Bill Kramer at several events, and there is a pattern of behavior, and he called it habitual. He didn't get into too many details there as to what that behavior was, but then he went on to say, we can't have sexual innuendos and bad language in the public. He said that, you know, he had just observed him at a recent conference. It was American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, conference. He said that Kramer did not represent well and said that can never happen. So, you know, it was a pretty big hint there, and happened very recently. And so, you know, Speaker Robin Voss was actually asked about that today, said, should people have listened to Chris Kapinga? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Voss said, you know, nobody had observed the type of behavior that Representative Kramer faces in these allegations now.
So at the time, he had the confidence of his colleagues, despite some hints that maybe things were not going to go well in the future.
Right. And, you know, it's just a sign today of how quickly things can change in the assembly. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, just a week ago, Bill Kramer was the majority leader, and, you know, no signs that that was going to change anytime soon. You know, he went to Washington, D.C. to represent his caucus at, a pretty big fundraiser. And, you know, now today he had not a single person stand up and speak on his behalf.
What details do we know about the rehab facility that Kramer has reportedly checked himself into?
If the details are out there, I don't know any of them. And nobody's really gotten into what type of treatment center it is. We do know Speaker Voss said that in one of the incidents, one of the alleged incidents, that Representative Kramer was impaired, that he'd been drinking. Other times he was not. And so, you know, you could make a guess that the treatment involves alcohol, but we don't know that. I mean, we just haven't seen information put out about that. And, you know, because of the nature of these treatment centers, it may be that Representative Kramer is actually basically closed off from the outside world now. And so we haven't heard from him about what's going on, and we're unlikely to for a while.
Is there expected to be a political price tag, maybe among Assembly Republicans, for Bill Kramer's his actions? Or is the fact that he was quickly removed and replaced with a woman, will that kind of take care of it and call it done?
Well, I mean, there is a recent history, actually, in the state assembly of the assembly censuring another state representative for behavior that they didn't think was appropriate. And that was Jeff Woods, a Republican lawmaker turned independent who had repeat drunk driving incidents on his record. Republicans sought to censure him, and that was after Woods started voting with Democrats. So, you know, we have a pretty recent incident where the assembly did stand up and make a public showing that, hey, we don't support that. Speaker Voss says they have no plans of doing that in the remaining two floor session days that are scheduled for this legislative session. And he says that he just hopes that Representative Kramer does not seek re-election. If he does come back to the legislature, Voss says that they'll have to put some type of safety measures in place for people that still work in the assembly who have concerns with Kramer.
Now, you mentioned Representative Pat Strakota, the new majority leader in the assembly. Will there be pressure after she leaves to leave that leadership role in the hands of a woman?
I think that's possible, yeah. I mean, Republicans know that Democrats, one of their attacks against the Republican Party has been that Republicans are engaging in this war on women. And so when you have incidents like the Kramer incident pop up, it bolsters Democrats' case. And so, you know, they elected a woman today, and looking ahead, it could be that they want to do that in the future. Although I imagine that you're going to have some competition for that majority leader job, given, you know, how high ranking it is.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter, and he was with us to talk about the vote to remove Assembly Majority Leader Bill Cramer on grounds of recent sexual harassment allegations.
A lot of us here at Central Time enjoy a good work of science fiction or fantasy every now and then, and sometimes you wonder whether or not the stuff in these books and movies could actually happen in real life.
Well, our next guest decided to take it one step further. In a new book, he looks at popular works of science fiction and fantasy through the lens of physics and math. And by applying real-life formulas to some of the scientific questions that these works pose, he tries to figure out what could be reality and what's just out of this world.
Charles Adler joins us now. He's a professor of physics at St. Mary's College of Maryland and the author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships, Physics and Math in Fantasy and Science Fiction. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, you're a physicist and you grew up as a fan of science fiction. What made you want to put those two together and apply the scientific lessons you knew to the fiction you were reading?
Well, I actually started as a scientist because I read science fiction. I started reading the science fiction first and got interested in science because of all these, you know, strange and neat ideas like space travel or, you know, artificial intelligence, things like that, in meeting aliens in the science fiction books that I was reading, and it led me into science. But as I started learning more and more science, I started to realize that a lot of the science portrayed in science fiction stories wasn't all that accurate. And so I started thinking about what was more realistic and what wasn't realistic. And so I kind of brought it all together again when I started looking at this book. It's a book I've been thinking about quite literally since I was about 15 years old.
As someone who's a fan of science fiction and fantasy, and also, you know, the math and you know the physics, do you get more out of these works of sci-fi and fantasy by knowing the math and the underpinnings beneath them?
Sure. I think knowing more helps you enjoy them more. I mean, my daughters will sometimes look at me and say, well, why are you spoiling the story for us, Dad? But I actually do think that thinking about it more helps you enjoy it more. You know, I won't say that I will expect every piece of science fiction to be completely accurate, and that I won't enjoy it unless it is. But I think it does add something to the story to see where it is accurate and to actually enjoy a story that's, you know, well-crafted and where people have actually been thinking about the science in it.
Well, what surprised me was you don't start off with science fiction. You start off with Harry Potter, a fantasy thing. And usually with fantasy, you think, oh, that doesn't make sense. Oh, well, it's magic. But you are looking at least for some sort of internal consistency and some obedience to scientific principles, even with the magic. Why?
Well, because if you look at it, there are actually a large number of fantasy writers who do pay attention to that sort of thing. Poole Anderson, for example, who is better known as a science fiction writer, did write several fantasy novels in which he actually did pay attention to some, not all the laws of science, but some of the laws of science, like, for example, the law of conservation of mass. He paid attention to these, and I think it kind of enriched the stories because it kind of put boundaries on what the people in the stories could do and couldn't do. I love the Harry Potter stories, but you do sometimes get a sense that J.K. Rowling was sort of making up the rules as she went along. You know, there are a number of things in the stories which you look at and you start thinking, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. For example, I mean, in the third book, they give, you know, a time machine, you know, for crying out loud, to the equivalent of a high school student in order for her to take more class.
Right, in the form of what? It's a watch, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's a watch. It could get easily lost. Someone could pick it up and start using it for their own purposes. Even if not, the potential is that, you know, she could do a whole lot of damage just by using a time machine there. And so, you know, it's there to provide a story, provide a plot point for the story, but it doesn't make a lot of sense when you view it, you know, kind of in a larger context.
Well, let's dig into some of the other science that you just mentioned in passing there, mass conservation. Now, this is something that involves a plot line where Draco Malfoy gets turned into a ferret.
Always with the ferrets on this show.
Yeah.
So tell me, how does that go over scientifically?
Not that well, because there's this law we call the conservation of mass energy. It's the most famous formula in physics, E equals mc squared. You can't get rid of mass, you can convert it into energy, or a better way of saying it might be that mass is a form of energy in some sense, but it can be converted at a very, very high price. 90,000 trillion joules for every kilogram of matter, about 2 pounds or so of matter, that you turn into energy. And put that in context, that's enough for every kilogram that you do, that's enough energy to power the United States, all of its energy needs, for about 8 hours. So if you think about turning Draco into a ferret, if all that excess mass gets released as energy, that's something like the equivalent of 10 hydrogen bombs going off all at once. So you start thinking about these things, you think, well, every time that something gets turned into something else, Hogwarts ought to be flattened by an atomic bomb, the equivalent of an atomic bomb explosion.
That may have been a tough plot point to work around there.
Right. You can think of lots of fun things like this. You start thinking, E equals MC squared can actually get you very, very far with a lot of these things. If you remember the Enterprise, for example, in Star Trek, going to a science fiction example, the Enterprise is powered by, matter-antimatter reactions.
Sounds like Scani.
Yeah. The idea is very simple. You take matter and you take antimatter in equal quantities and you toss them together and they convert themselves, you annihilate the matter and antimatter into pure energy, essentially light in the form of very, very, very high energy X-rays, gamma rays, we typically call them. And you can actually use that to move a starship forward. It's a very, very effective way of doing it. There were actually serious proposals back in the 1980s by a scientist, not coincidentally also a science fiction writer, named Robert Forward, to actually create matter and antimatter to use as fuel for starships, for spaceships. The problem is that antimatter doesn't really exist in the real universe in any large quantities. We produce tiny, tiny, tiny bits of it in particle accelerators all over the world, but at the equivalent cost of something like trillions of dollars per pound at today's energy prices. And when you're talking about something like the USS Enterprise, you're talking about, many millions of pounds of starship fuel that you'd need to power the spaceship. So you're looking at costs in fueling this thing of like trillions upon trillions of dollars, simply because of this idea of the conservation of mass and energy. You have to be able to, if you want to create antimatter out of nothing, you have to spend an enormous amount of energy to do it.
Well, on a little closer to Earth, where are those flying cars that the science fiction authors were promising us? Why aren't those more plausible?
I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think that one of the problems involved with that is that the fuel costs get very high. If you start looking at the fuel costs for, say, putting a a Toyota Corolla, something equivalent to that, in the air, you start talking about much, much, much larger engines. Flight is actually pretty energy expensive. If you start talking about, driving a car down and having it pull out wings like in James Bond stories and having it take off into flight, it turns out that it actually, in order to overcome the drag forces on the car, and keep it up in the air, it needs to exert a lot of energy. And as you make the car bigger, the energy costs actually scale disproportionately with the weight. It does turn out to be not very fuel economical in terms of fuel to actually get a car to fly. You also have the problem, of course, that if you run out of fuel in a car, for example, you can pull off to the side of the road. But doing the same thing in a flying car is not so much fun.
Well, then there's the question of the other drivers. I mean, it's bad enough working in two dimensions sometimes.
True. Right, exactly. And training them and all, I think driver's ed becomes a lot more difficult at that point as well, if you want to get people in. I think there have been some serious issues. There's some serious proposals that I've read about recently actually using computers to control the flight on the cars. You wouldn't have these issues with the drivers. But I think the fuel costs are still going to do it in the end.
Charles, just real quick, in our last moment of time here, what is the coolest thing that you found that actually is plausible in science fiction?
The coolest thing I found that's actually plausible in science fiction, I will say it's kind of on the border of plausibility. I'm a little dismissive of it in the book because I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but I love the idea of the space elevator. The idea of, a transport system to space, which would actually involve taking a satellite and stretching it out, so the one end goes up into space, the other end goes toward the ground, keeping the center of gravity in an orbit that stays at one point above the Earth's surface at all times, and stretching it to the point where it'll actually one end will touch the ground and the other end will go out to space. You can actually literally ride an elevator out into space. And it seems to be just barely what I love about the idea is that based on kind of materials issues, it seems to be just barely plausible.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Charles Adler, professor of physics at St. Mary's College of Maryland, author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships.
Last week, comedian Seth Rogen testified in front of a Senate appropriations panel in favor of more funding for Alzheimer's research. But how much does it matter when celebrities support causes? A political scientist discusses celebrity political activism, coming up later.
First, should the United States have a mandatory draft, a draft-related song there in the background? After a decade of war in Afghanistan and a long conflict in Iraq, there have been calls in Congress and elsewhere for rethinking how we recruit our military personnel with an eye toward changing the way we make our decisions about when to go to war.
Those who propose a draft or some kind of mandatory service say the civilian population has lost touch with the sacrifice of war and doesn't understand the consequences of military adventurism. They say a draft might make the U.S. less likely to wage new battles.
To help us understand the arguments and history behind the draft is Harper's executive editor James Marcus. His article, Dodge the Draft, appeared in this month's Harper's Magazine. James, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
The last draft in American history during the Vietnam War, to put it mildly, didn't go over very well with a lot of people. Some people are arguing, though, today that a mandatory draft should be reinstated. Why is that?
Well, I think there are several arguments that are connected to this call for a renewed draft. And you mentioned some of them in your introduction. There's a feeling that the country is very divided in terms of there are regional divisions, ethnic divisions, certainly economic divisions. Some of the pro-draft pundits feel like if every American was forced to serve with Americans of every different kind, that might close some of those gaps. Some of the pro-draft pundits feel like we need more veterans in the Congress, that the quality of our legislature would be improved by having more veterans in there. And paradoxically, some of them are proposing it almost as an anti-war measure in the sense that if everybody's children were in the armed forces, they're suggesting we would be much more reluctant to actually send them to war.
We've historically been pretty suspicious of the idea of a draft throughout American history. Can you walk us through how our attitudes toward conscription have evolved since the Founding Fathers?
Yeah, I mean, there was not a draft in the Revolutionary War. There were local militias and there was a volunteer army. And there were times during the war when a very frazzled George Washington would be pleading with the Continental Congress for more troops. But they were not at all willing to institute a national draft then because the country itself was a new and rather fragile entity. The first time there was a draft in American history was during the Civil War. The South actually instituted a draft first because it was short of soldiers and certainly was not about to ask its population of slaves to fight for the continuation of slavery. That was in 1862. Now, in 1863, the Union instituted the first national draft in sort of U.S. history, and that was met with some very violent opposition in different parts of the country. There were violent protests in Boston, Newark, Hartford, and Albany. The worst and the most famous, however, were New York City, which saw just incredibly ferocious draft rioting in 1863.
And part of the anger over that was because you could buy your way out of it, right?
Oh, yes. There was certainly a strong class element to this. According to the Enrollment Act of 1863, you could give the government $300 and avoid being drafted. Now, $300 was an enormous amount of money then. So it was essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card for rich people. And so there was a very powerful element of class resentment in these riots. There was also a nativist and racist elements to it as well. But mobs of up to 10,000 people just rampaged around Manhattan for, I think, five straight days. They destroyed draft offices, churches, homes. They pulled down telegraph lines. The only thing that actually put down these riots was the arrival of six regiments of federal troops who had just fought at Gettysburg and were probably saying to themselves, oh, my God, you know, we survived that, and now we have to go to New York City.
And then the World Wars, we had conscription, but that was pretty uncontroversial, wasn't it?
The World Wars were different. I think World War I was sold to the public as a struggle for civilization. It was probably the first American war where all the forces of sort of PR were turned upon the civilian population, and that's how people saw it. And so there were, you know, everyone was willing to serve. And obviously World War II was the good war, and once the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, it was a defensive conflict. So in both of those world wars, there wasn't a lot of trouble getting a large enough army to fight. But sort of the ghost of 1863 came back during the Vietnam War.
And what happened there? Obviously, that's a huge amount of history to ask you about, but how did the conscription in the Vietnam War lead to the political protest? And did that make the military a little gun-shy about bringing back a draft?
Yes, it certainly did. I mean, very much unlike World War I and World War II, the Vietnam War was increasingly resented by the American public. Eventually, that sense that we were fighting a war that we should not be fighting sort of bled into the military itself. And so by the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you saw a kind of slow-motion mutiny taking place in the armed forces. Sometimes it was just foot-dragging. Sometimes it was insubordination. But there began to be more and more fragging of superior officers, meaning killing them, you know, making it look like an accident sometimes, a grenade that rolls into a tunnel, and sometimes just shooting them. And there was more of this going on than the Army was willing to admit at the time, and it really spooked the armed forces. So in 1973, when Defense Secretary Melvin Laird said that conscription was over, the armed forces did not protest. You know, they were very much spooked by what happened when you coerce soldiers into fighting a long-term war that many of them did not want to fight.
That takes us up to the present day, and James Marcus of Harper's stay with us. Earlier today, we spoke with Professor of History and International Relations at Boston University, Andrew Basevich, about the idea of a skin in the game argument that James Marcus touched on earlier, the idea that if people are disconnected from the military, they don't have a stake in what American foreign policy looks like and our decision to intervene militarily looks like. Andrew Basevich served in both the Vietnam and Persian Gulf Wars. He lost a son in Iraq. Here's what he had to say.
Well, what is the skin in the game argument for bringing back a draft?
Well, I'm not sure it's an argument for bringing back a draft. It is an argument, however, for trying to re-engage the American people with their military. And the skin in the game argument simply is that when you don't have a stake, when you don't feel the effects, when you don't have to pay, you become less interested in what's going on. And my critique of U.S. military policy over the last couple of decades would be one that the American people have paid insufficient attention to where their soldiers are being sent and how their soldiers are being used, and that this has contributed to defective policies.
So the bulk of us don't have a personal connection when troops are sent to war. It's always, in effect, somebody else or somebody else's kid going.
That's exactly right. I mean, when you think about the fact, I mean, the president has made frequent references to us being a nation at war for well over a decade. And in a country of, what, 315 million people, the percentage of people who have been directly affected, who have a stake, who care, is quite small. And for someone like myself who thinks that at least the Iraq War was unnecessary and both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been mismanaged, as I look for explanations for how our policies have been so wrong-headed, I've reached the conclusion that one of the reasons is that the American people have disengaged from their military.
Would you support a mandatory draft or some kind of even mandatory military service to try to build that bridge to get that connection to a nation at war?
No, my argument is a little bit broader than that, maybe a little bit ambitious, and in that sense, maybe politically impossible, but I think we should consider a program of national service. And let me explain why a national service is not to be mistaken for a draft. National service says that every young person at age, let's say 18, owes a couple years of service to country or community, with that service being fulfilled in a variety of ways. There'll be a menu. One item on the menu is to join the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, whatever, But other items would be join the Peace Corps, you know, join a new version of the Civilian Conservation Corps, join Teach for America, but that everybody, in fact, would have an obligation to serve as part of becoming a citizen.
On the side of the military, would they want that? Do they want more random people? Maybe it's not compulsory military service, but a lot more people would be in there. Do they want that broader pool, or do they want the volunteers that they're getting now?
No, it's a very good question. We've got an officer corps that is accustomed to relying on long service professionals. Let's call them professional soldiers. And from the perspective of somebody who's commanding a battalion, let's say, there's a lot of advantages to relying on long service regulars. But the preferences of the officer corps should not necessarily determine the basic military system of the United States.
Would having something like this in play ultimately make us less likely to go to war?
Well, arguably yes, and I don't think it would guarantee. I don't think a closing the gap between the military and society would somehow guarantee that there would be no unnecessary wars or badly managed wars. I think it would, however, reduce the likelihood. Why? Because the American people, if they had skin in the game, would be somewhat more attentive to what our policies consisted of in substantive terms.
You have had skin in the game serving in Vietnam and the Persian Gulf, your family as well. How did that affect the way you view war and American foreign policy?
Well, I don't know. It's true that I have a personal history in all this, but I think that my position derives more from being a student of history and trying to evaluate in a detached way the course of American foreign policy, particularly since the end of the Cold War, trying to understand why, in recent decades, the country has shown this preference for using military might, trying to understand why, despite the fact that in so many respects we have a superior military, nonetheless the outcomes of our wars are less than satisfactory. It's a complicated issue, in my judgment, is that at least one component of an answer deals with the military system that we have, that we've come to rely on. I think what we have is a military system that is not democratic. Given the way the maldistribution of sacrifice, I don't think it's moral, and perhaps worst of all, it's not effective. You know, we don't win. We have lots of wars. The wars go on a long time. They don't end successfully. They cost a lot. And it seems to me that any citizen who is paying attention would be saying, there's something wrong here. And we ought to be trying to find out what's wrong and to, therefore, make the necessary corrective action.
Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Basevich of Boston University. I talked to him earlier today. Harper's executive editor James Marcus stays with us as we talk about the idea of bringing back a military draft in the United States. We're done in Afghanistan, or we'll be soon done in Iraq, but how will we choose whether or not to go to war in the future?
And we'd like to hear from you on this one. Do you think there should be a universal draft? Do you think it would make Americans less likely to want to go to war and America more invested in foreign policy? Or do you think an all-volunteer force is better, what we have now? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back now with Harper's executive editor James Marcus, and we're talking about whether or not there should be a draft for the U.S. military. As the United States considers future conflicts, who should be invested in the decisions?
And we'd like to hear from you about the idea of bringing back a draft in the United States. Join in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. James, just a few minutes ago, we heard Andrew Basevich making the case for universal service of some sort. There have been calls for bringing back a draft. Who is making that call in recent years?
Well, what struck me as I began to look into this issue was that these calls tended to come not from the military. They came from fairly moderate voices like Dana Milbank at the Washington Post or Thomas E. Ricks, who is an historian and a journalist himself. They've been, the calls have also come from Representative Charles Rangel of New York City. The military itself does not seem to want a renewed draft. The officers I spoke to in the course of reporting this piece said that as long as the geopolitical situation remains stable, stable meaning the way it is now, and we're not fighting a sort of massive existential conflict for our survival, they feel that the AVF is better for them. I found it very interesting that the military itself was not calling for this resumed draft. It was people outside of the military.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Ben on the line in Madison. Ben, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call because I ended up joining in 2001 for the Montgomery GI Bill, and I joined because it was my own choice. And I feel as though if a draft was instated, a lot of people that would be pulled into it would be really wanting out, and it would cause a lot of friction in the military culture, because a lot of people that join, when they join for whatever benefit they're joining, either to provide for their family or to get the college money, they're wanting, even then, they're kind of wanting out. They're kind of always second-guessing themselves, so it's really hard to stay focused and to have that motivation. But then if it was the other route where the senator was saying where you could join based on your preference, so you'd either join, say, the Peace Corps or something locally in your state where you're helping the community, but you had to join something, then you'd get people that would be able to, one, psychologically prepare themselves so they know, hey, I can either join the military and I'll get these benefits, or I can join this, and then it would just, it'd be a softer way to get people and to provide both sides of the benefits.
All right, thanks for the call, Ben. And that's part of the military's worry, isn't it, they want people who want to be there, James.
They very much want people who want to be there. When I got a communication from a DOD spokesman about this, a big part of it was, we want troops who have not been coerced into joining. I would just add that Andrew Basevich, who is a contributor to Harper's Magazine and a board member here, and who I spoke to in my own article, is someone I respect a great deal, and I'm not really on the opposite side from him in many senses, not the least in that I think there are some excellent arguments to be made for some kind of universal national service. What I find a little confusing and maybe counterproductive is I feel if you want a domestic peace corps, then propose that on its own terms and don't bolt it together with a draft, which is also a Representative Charles Rangel has proposed five times since 2003 something called the Universal National Service Act. And again, that is kind of a two-pronged thing where you either can volunteer for military service or civilian service, where you might be teaching or, you know, building infrastructure, helping the community. And I think that that's a great idea. Certainly many strong arguments for it, but I feel like the two things should be kept separate. And if you want to propose a draft, then you should propose that on its own terms as well.
Thanks for the call, Ben. We've got Cindy with us now in Prairie du Chien. Cindy, hi.
Hi. My comment is almost the same as Ben's. I am a proud parent of two Army soldiers, and I do not believe there should be a draft, because if those soldiers do not want to be there, you do not know if they're going to go in and do the job that they were recruited to do.
All right. Thanks for that call, Cindy. And we'll go straight to another caller, Mac in Milwaukee. Mac, hi. What do you think about this?
Well, I believe that there should be one, because the people are losing their backbones, right? Personal opinion. That it teaches discipline. It teaches people how to understand what to understand. Yes, they might not like it, but it may be that they don't like it now, but they grow into it, and that way America isn't a spineless backbone anymore.
Thanks for the call, Mac. Thanks to both of you for those calls. And James, that's another thread in arguments in favor of a draft, the idea that Americans are soft, we lack discipline, and this putting everybody at risk or in the military would change that.
There are all sorts of arguments about the social fabric of the nation being weak or being, you know, torn up in all sorts of ways. I guess I would like to find a way to build our national character without putting, you know, 2 million young Americans into uniform. I don't think that's the only way to do it. I recognize the underlying problem, but I guess I'm not persuaded that a universal draft is the solution to that problem.
When this gets talked about, I mean, some of the people proposing the idea of a draft are wanting it to affect American foreign policy. The military being opposed to this is don't change our effectiveness for political reasons. Is that the main back and forth on this?
Well, I mean, that's part of the back and forth. The other factor that has not yet come up in this conversation is that, well, there are two things. I mean, we are in an era when we can fight most of the wars we fight with a smaller force that is much more technologically adept than older armies were. We don't tend to fight wars now where you need a million troops in the battlefield, you know. The other thing is that we are in a somewhat more austere period, fiscally speaking. And indeed, you know, just in the last week or so, Defense Secretary Hagel unveiled a new military budget for 2015 and looking down the road. And in fact, he is proposing to shrink the Army size down to 440,000 troops by 2019, which is the smallest standing army we would have had since 1940, since before World War II. So there are also economic factors going on here, and there are just the changing nature of warfare itself. And I think that's also part of the reason why the military itself remains more comfortable with a smaller force. They are recognizing some of these financial restrictions, and they also are recognizing a different force is called for in a different age of warfare.
James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Happy to be here.
We've been speaking with James Marcus, executive editor at Harper's, about the concept of bringing back a military draft. His article in this month's Harper's Magazine is called Dodge the Draft.